Welcome to the REI Mastermind Network, where host Jack Haas gathers amazing stories from leaders in real estate investing. In each episode, our guests will tell you what they're doing that works, what they've tried that failed, and best of all, you'll learn actionable steps to take your real estate investing to the next level. Now, here's Jack with another value-packed episode.
We have the data scientist of real estate, George Roberts, with me here today, and you're going to find him on LinkedIn. So look for George Roberts, and I'm going to have a clickable link in the show notes so you're easy to find, George. But appreciate your time today as we talk about some numbers associated with real estate investing.
Sounds good. It's what I love to do.
So I'm curious because, you know, based on what I've read about you, you have quite the background, not only in genetics, microbiology, physiology, and now data science. People would be questioning, why are you in real estate investing?
Yeah, it's been a long and storied career. I started out as an empirical scientist, spent a lot of time at the bench, very busy physically doing work. And I got to a point in my life where, you know, my arthritis was really kind of holding me back. So I wanted to go into computer science. And that really led me straight into real estate. I was in fintech, realized that some of the very best opportunities are in real estate right now, and multifamily, particularly commercial real estate, but multifamily in particular. I thought this is a place where not only can you do real estate at scale, but it's also relatively easy to break into. So I wasted no time and beat a trail to commercial real estate.
Yeah, it's interesting. Did you jump directly into commercial real estate? Did your numbers guide you there?
Yes and no. So there was a false start, as many things in life. I became a landlord in 2010. So I had some experience with it. Around 2016, my sister came to me and said, hey, let's start a construction company. Well, that introduced me to the world of entrepreneurship. So when I wanted my own gig, I had to go to something that I already knew, which was being a landlord, and decided to just simply be a landlord at scale. So yeah, so I had one long false start for about a decade. And then in 2020, I jumped in with both feet, did my first commercial real estate deal. And from there, just no looking back.
So I'd be curious, you know, based on what you've experienced and what you've seen now over the course of your years in commercial real estate, what are the numbers showing you regarding the forecast and how things have been working out, especially with our last few couple of years of COVID and the like?
Well, you know, we've been through a lot. We've seen some major interest rate hikes over the last couple of years, completely changing every forecast. This underscores what I would consider the three essential words of investing, which are margin of safety. You always have to go into everything with a margin of safety. Margin of safety meaning that obviously you underpromise and overdeliver, but perhaps even more importantly, you always got to have reserves on the side no matter what. So we've seen things get a lot worse and people are questioning right now, is this the time to invest? Yes, absolutely. The time to invest is when the blood is running in the streets. And if you can get in now into a relatively safe deal, something that cash flows, if you got the reserves on the side, if anything goes wrong and you can survive, 1 year, 2 year, 3 years from now, you're going to be sitting pretty and you're going to have the experience to fully take advantage of that lower interest rate environment.
Is there anything in particular that you hunt for in the commercial space? Anything from storage units to retail front? What type of commercial spaces are you personally investing in right now?
Right. Yeah. So personally, as an active investor, I'm looking in multifamily. You've got to stay in your lane. You've got to be focused. It's the only way to truly get out there and win. But as a passive investor, I'm investing much further afield, car washes, drug rehab, love triple net. It's great to be a passive investor as well because there's no reason to limit yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd love to get more into the active if you'd like. I think you need to look for things that others are not looking for, right? So if everybody's looking for that 200-unit deal where you can have on-site management, consider also that there are perhaps many more great deals that might be 30 or 40 units and might have a mom and pop seller, where you can get in at a much better cost basis, have a much stronger margin of safety, and you might have below market rents. There may be far more things that you can optimize on the operational front. So I think that you always want to differentiate yourself.
And you could correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought I saw a statistic recently where the smaller units that you're talking about, the 30, 40, or even under units, are still like 80% of them are still mom and pop or small companies versus large corporations.
Yeah, well, as for your statistic, I don't know exactly where that comes from, but I can tell you that the further you get afield, the more likely that is to be true. So if you're willing to go out, say, into a tertiary market, boom, then you have just added another layer between you and the rabble.
So you're talking about multifamily, maybe kind of smaller type properties, let's say 50 units and under. Where are you finding these deals today, and are you focused on certain regions of the U.S.?
I am. So I focus a lot on networking. I think we're going to go into that later, I hope. But people bring me deals from all over. But I let it be known that there are certain places that I do like. I started out in Central Florida, still looking for deals out there, although it's getting harder. I love Kansas City, love the middle of the country. I think the middle of the country is doing really great. Everybody talks about the South, and the South has directed or attracted, I should say, tons of people. And for a long time, maybe that was the very, very best place to be. But you got some places like the Upper South, places like, you know, East Tennessee, certain parts of Kentucky, Cincinnati, Kansas City. Midwest has really been doing very, very well. Not so much because the Midwest is outrunning the rest of the country, but because the rest of the country stumbled. And you have to look out for that. I mean, yesterday's winners are today's losers in real estate. And you have to look for those reorganizations and see where you can take advantage of it.
You said you got to take advantage when the blood is running in the streets. What type of blood are you seeing, and what is the cause of those cuts right now?
Well, the first thing is people assume that interest rates would go up, or at least not like they have. Seems reasonable enough. We have seen unprecedented increases in interest rates. But I'll tell you that there's something that underpins all of the greatest disasters in investing, and that is not looking out for the black swan. It's always the black swan that gets you. So you have to not only expect the unexpected, but again, margin of safety. If I was going to summarize my entire investing thesis in three words, that would be what it is. You have to be so far ahead of the game that even the black swan can't get you.
You've mentioned the margin of safety quite a couple times here now. What do you mean by that, and how do you calculate it?
Right. So first of all, it comes from Benjamin Graham. He got his teeth in the Great Depression. He lost a lot of money. Talking about Warren Buffett's mentor, of course, a man of great integrity. He returned all the money to his investors, although he was not under any obligation to do so. He could have cut his losses and ran. Well, he didn't just, you know, lick his wounds. He came back stronger, and he came back with method of investing, which I would say is the only true method of investing, which is value investing. I think all investing is value investing on some level. And if it's not value investing, then it's speculation to one degree or another. So I build margin of safety in many ways. For example, looking for the more stable markets. You can take a look and you can see prices. For example, if you want to look at multifamily, Freddie Mac has over 20 markets that are tracked, and you can see how stable these markets are going back to 2000. If you look at single family, you can find just about any market that you're interested in looking at. Look for those stable markets. Look in the tertiary markets. Look at the mom and pop deals. Look for undermarket rents. That there are at least a dozen ways that you can build margin of safety into a deal.
So I understand that you also focus on a value add when it comes to multifamily. Is that part of the margin of safety that you're looking into?
Well, it certainly does help to inflate the returns. So in a certain sense, it is. But to at the same time maintain the security, what I like to do is focus on seller financing. Another reason why I do like small deals, because say that you go into a bigger deal with, agency financing. Great. It's beautiful financing. You can't, you hardly can beat it, but unless you get seller financing. But then you've got all these covenants, but you don't have these covenants restricting what you can do if you got seller financing. You can take the occupancy down to zero. Nobody's going to say anything. And you just, they're not going to look at your debt service coverage ratio. That really, these contracts are not written in such a way in general as to tie your hands. You're able to do a lot of things that you couldn't do. You may get below market interest rates. You may get more interest only than you could get from agency financing. And it's, as far as I've ever seen, always been fixed. So I would say take advantage of it. Make sure that you're writing a contract that's certainly to the benefit of the seller as well. It's got to be win-win, but that truly protects your investors and allows you to continue to do the value add you want to do, but without exposing you to the risk of the variable interest rates.
Did you find that you said you had your initial stumbling? I would imagine some of that might have been in single family homes or the like. Have you found that people are more receptive to the seller financing in commercial property than they would be otherwise in other asset classes?
Well, certainly more receptive than you might imagine. And I think some of it comes from gurus. The gurus will tell you, you know, hey, go for, you know, 100 or 200 units. Seller financing is not really a thing in commercial real estate. Why are they saying that? Well, they're saying it because they can sign on the loan. And those are the sorts of deals that it makes sense to go in with on, you know, with a student. But it's not really the case. You'll find other mentors, people like Pace Morby, who will tell you, you know, hey, I do seller financing all day long in commercial real estate. So I think the first thing that you got to know is that it really exists. And then you have to be willing to broach the subject, and you have to be willing to broach it in the right way. If you go to a broker and say, hey, have you got anything with seller financing? They're going to put the phone down as quick as they can. But if you find something that's a little rough and maybe a smaller deal, and you can tell you're dealing with a smaller operator, and maybe you get the backstory on the property, and maybe you can see that it really makes sense. Maybe there's going to be a windfall profit on this property. Maybe there's a way to make it win-win. You know, you have to establish your credibility. It's not the first thing you say out of the box. And then you might mention, well, you know, we're not going to be able to obtain proper financing on this thing for many reasons. Like maybe it's too small that you can't get the agency financing, or it's too rough, and then you'd have to go and get a bridge loan. And then you point out, hey, your underwriting here, I respect your underwriting, but to hit these numbers, you know, we need this interest rate, and we're not going to get that with a bridge.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that your networking group and how you leverage that to find these, find some of your opportunities. In fact, our networking has been some of the most profitable, I don't know why I want to call it marketing, but that's the most profitable way we found deals as well. Could you talk a little bit about your particular group, what somebody could expect, and what's the purpose behind it?
Yeah, so the purpose is to get together, have fun, do deals, and become wealthy. And the way I do that, and the way I try and make it a little bit different than other groups, is that if you come to me and you tell me I have like a certain sort of person I'm looking for, like I'm looking for capital, or maybe you say, hey, you know, I need to be in a room with this person, just let me know. And I try to make that happen. So I call it CRE, Commercial Real Estate Networking at Noon Eastern. And what we try to make it really about deals. I mean, I know that's why everyone is there in the first place, but I just want to put it front and center, because if you go to a networking event and you know what you have to offer and you know what you're looking for from other people, when people ask the question, you know, hey, how can I help you? You have to have an answer for that. So if you come to these meetings and you come prepared, and that's what I really try to hammer home, I think you can get a lot done in a 1-hour networking session.
How would they join this type of group?
Yeah, come find me on LinkedIn. It is one of my featured posts. And if you have any trouble finding it, just reach out to me either through LinkedIn, or you can find me at george@robertscapitalenterprises.com. I'd be happy to send you the link.
Just to remind everybody, I'm going to have that link as a clickable one in the show notes. Again, if you found some value in what George and I have been talking about so far, do us a quick favor and share it with one of your investor friends. And give us a thumbs up if you're watching this on YouTube. So I'd be interested then, George, you know, you're talking about your seller financing option. Do you do any kind of raising of capital for syndications for any of these projects?
I do. I started rather early. My second project, I was a co-GP. And from there, I've been a general partner. I love raising capital because I love people. It's a great excuse to then go out, network, meet people, help people. Beautiful thing. Yes. Love it.
So what was some of the biggest challenges moving from your background, it's in the sciences, to real estate investing? What was some of the biggest gaps you had to find a way to fill?
Well, everything at the outset, because everything was new. But I realized after some time, and it wasn't immediately clear how to repurpose myself, that, you know what? I do have a lot in my background that's valuable. And I think you need to do some soul searching. I did a lot of soul searching. I talked a lot with my wife, you know, hey, this is what I do. This is what I've done. You know, how do I bridge that gap? And together we came up with the idea of that I'm going to take this data science background. So I'm actually an award-winning data scientist. I have the credibility. I have the desire. I have, and that's really more than anything. A lot of people have their careers. They hate them. That's how they get into real estate. It's like, I want to get out of this. But I loved what I was doing. It was beautiful. And now I just do it in a, on a grander scale.
I'd be curious as to, I don't want to say the normies, but the way you look at properties and analyze properties, it sounds like it's very data centric and data first mentality. And you've probably have talked to and worked with a number of other investors at this point to have kind of an idea. How do you see underwriting a property versus the normal real estate investor?
Well, I think the first thing that people do with numbers, which is wrong, is they get intimidated. They look at numbers like it's something set in stone. But the first thing you learn about numbers is that they're very untrustworthy. Where did this number come? What's its provenance? So one of the mistakes that I see early investors make is they just try to fill in the spreadsheet. It's like, let's tick all the boxes, right? But from working many years with databases, I know that the real work begins only after you vet every data point coming in. That's the work. The real work of data analysis is, you know, what data do I have? How much do I trust it? Where are our blind spots? And what can we do to fill those gaps in?
So have you created your own model or something now to underwrite these opportunities?
So I'm working on that. One of the things I'm doing with the book that I'm writing right now is helping passive investors track their progress. So this is a sort of a first step towards that. There are multiple models that I work with. I have not done my own, but that is definitely something on the horizon.
You could correct me if I'm wrong, but I know quite a few computer scientists that I would classify as introvert, to say the least. You've mentioned a couple times now how much you love working with people. Is that abnormal in your world, like being a data scientist?
So yeah, I would say that from where I come, there's a range of people, and IT can be full of some pretty interesting characters, particularly in empirical science, where you really have to sit down at the bench and you're turned away from everyone else. You have your back to your neighbors and working all day. Yes, I think I did break the mold a little bit, but even there, I learned early on that it's getting out, you know, of that laboratory stool when things are going wrong. Sure, go to the library perhaps, but really go down the hall or call somebody, contact somebody. When things are going wrong, you know, the sooner that you reach out, the better. So even in science, which I consider to be one of the most introverted fields, having the ability to network and the willingness to go out and say, you know, hey, this isn't working. You know, what might I be missing? Is a great way to enhance your career. And the best thing about it is it takes no talent at all. I mean, wouldn't it be nice if we all had a 140 IQ? But, you know, being able to set your pride aside and go out and network and say, you know, hey, I'd like a little help with this. Yeah, it was huge. And so from there, I think I just built on it again and again. I read Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People. Very influential to me, because I think if I'd summarized the whole book in a sentence, If you learn to value other people, you'll find out just how valuable they are. And though I may be naturally introverted, I came to realize that being an extrovert just brings greater rewards.
Hmm. So, you know, one of the things that I think is also interesting is that you, being a data scientist, it's easy for you to kind of get deep in the weeds on a lot of information. What steps did you take or skills did you have to hone in order to simplify it so everybody can understand?
Well, the best data scientists tell stories through numbers. And I think that if you really want to be good with numbers, sure, facility, algorithms, proofs, this is part of understanding numbers. But the people who do the most with numbers in an applied sense are the ones who can find the story behind. The real underwriting is not that, hey, I filled this out and it's 17% IRR. And the real underwriting is not even that I verified all these numbers and I called up, you know, the assessor's office and, you know, I got, you know, these consultants and such that you can find for taxes. You can do all kinds of things to verify your numbers, including make sure you get the very best quotes for your insurance, tie things down. That's just base level. The real underwriting, and I would say real capital raising, is all about telling the story. So you project 17% IRR, but why? Why is the seller selling? Why is this such a good deal? How did you have access to this deal? I could tell you my first deal. How do we have access to it? Well, everybody around us had already repositioned the apartments, but this was too small. So I have to ask myself, how did this come to me? Well, it came to me because the other people around me who had the talent to do this, they were looking for 100 or 150 units. We did 14 units, did very well with that deal. So what is the real story behind the deal? For that first deal, the story is that, hey, everybody's repositioned around us. It makes sense. The business model has been proven out. And for us, 14 units is a big deal. So you have to go in and you have to be able to tell that story behind the numbers. When I hear somebody and they just hit me with number, it tells me that either they don't see the story behind the deal, which makes me a little bit frightened, or they haven't yet learned to tell the story.
Hmm. Well, would you mind sharing a couple stories? What is the best deal you've done so far?
Okay, best deal ever. Again, networking. I was part of a mastermind group for a long time. My mastermind was Horizon Multifamily. We turned it into a company. We did a few deals together. One of our partners really taught me a lot about these mom and pop deals. I call it playing the long game. So the story behind my third deal, the first one where I was a general partner, he was driving around his own town where he owned 13 units. He saw this one property driving for dollars. People say, well, that's not really a thing in multifamily. Well, it is. He saw something that looked maybe, you know, could use a little love. Only way to contact the seller, there was a number on the pool shed. Well, over 5 years, he called twice. After the second call, he got an incoming call 2 weeks later. Yeah, you know what? The seller's ready to deal. And he was able to get, this was 2021, late 2021, he was able to get 3.5% interest rate. 7 years, it's fixed. No restrictive covenants. We didn't have to take the vacancy occupancy down, but we could have if we wanted to. I mean, this thing cash flows like a champ, 3.5%. And we can just hold on to this thing for another 5 years. And it's a beautiful thing. So how did we get the deal? How did it come to us? Well, tenacity. Someone willing to play the long game. Now, if you're doing that, you got to have a lot in your pipeline, but he did. And how did it come to us? Well, we're willing to deal with the smaller deals in the tertiary markets, willing to deal where there's no broker. And the only way to call is you've got to go drive by and get the number. And in the end, we get something that had far below market rents. We had the opportunity to make improvements because I don't think much had been done since the most recent building was constructed in 1997. And literally everything from the financing to the quality of the deal, the cost basis, everything was beautiful.
You mentioned tenacity, and I've learned a while ago that, and you also talked about people's IQ. Would you agree with the concept that I think tenacity, that persistent, consistent behavior will trump any level of IQ?
100%. I've seen it my entire life. Even in a field like science, it's not the brightest people that survive. It's the people who stick with it. I mean, if you walk down the halls in any research institution, you'll find people that are demoralized about their research. And some people see it through. And others don't.
So you just shared a story of your biggest win. Could you tell me a story about your biggest learning scenario? Like what is one of the biggest event that's happened so far, and what lessons did you learn?
Sure. Well, this is a story that's still developing. About 15 months ago, I got into a Class D property. Now, as you know, all of these look good on paper, but they are very difficult to run. We had two bad property managers, and after getting rid of both of them and self-managing, now we're cash flowing. But we had 15 months of pain. So when you get into a new asset class, or even new class of asset within your asset class, be careful. Don't use someone else's money. And we didn't. So the whole thing turned out to be quite a seminar, as Rod Cleef says. But the important thing is we didn't have anybody else's money at stake, which was the only reason I was willing to go into it in the first place. And we're not going to lose any of our own money. But again, you lose time. And a lot of entrepreneurs call it brain damage, right? When you end up getting into something where you have to get into the weeds and it's taking all your time, brain damage. That's time that you could have spent on some higher or better use. So I can't say that I've lost money in real estate yet, and I've been in many deals, but some deals are harder than others.
So you had to fire two property managers in this particular deal to turn it around. What type of things did they have to implement in order to turn it around?
Yeah, well, basically, they didn't do anything at all. That was the problem. Second one, we had to resort to legal action. And we got some bad legal advice, actually. First lawyer we reached out to, I'm thinking, write a letter today. Tell them the contract is over. You are not doing the job, okay? And he said, no, you didn't set him up to fire him, which is true. You want to fire somebody in this day and age, you need to set them up. But went to a second lawyer, and immediately, she's someone who's helped us with true deals already, said, okay, yeah, that's what we're going to do. We're going to write the letter. I'm thinking like, are you kidding me? My wife's worked for lawyers for like 20 years. Okay. That's where I learned a lot about what I know about lawyers. First thing you do is you have a lawyer write a nasty letter if somebody is putting you in that situation. So get out of the contract as soon as possible. It doesn't matter what it says, because if you're ready to fire a property manager, there is a reason. So yeah, contact a lawyer. Best time to contact a lawyer is before you need one. Contact that lawyer as soon as possible. Plop down the retainer. Tell him what's happening and pull the trigger. So every month we spent in that situation was a loss.
Yeah. You know, it's always interesting. You know, a lot of people, especially when they're getting into real estate investing for the first time, they see what you're talking about there is an expense, but you talk as if you see it as an investment or a protection in many aspects.
Can be.
So just again, remind everybody, find George Roberts on LinkedIn. That's going to be a clickable link in the show notes. This has been a great conversation, George. Thanks for bearing with all my nerdy questions. With that, I'd like to close out with some rapid fire questions.
I love it. Let's hit it.
What lie do real estate investors tell themselves and others?
Oh, just do a deal, because doing a bad deal will hurt you more than doing a good deal will help you.
What book would you recommend, or what are you reading right now?
I've already recommended it. How to Win Friends and Influence People. Best for your personal life, fabulous for business.
If you could go back in time and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would that be?
So don't worry, be happy. I mean, throughout my life, I've worked so hard, always worried about the outcome hanging in the balance. Don't worry about it. Just work hard, be tenacious. It's going to be all right.
So, George, and I didn't warn you about this one, so it might not actually be on the list that you saw. So if you need a second, don't worry about it. What single strategy, process, or tool have you implemented that has a direct time-saving impact on your business?
Well, the simplest thing, I think, is don't get caught in the scroll. Best thing to start with is just cut off the fat. But what you really need to do is you need to put focus time on your calendar. Most important, highest, best use of my time is spent, if I'm not going on podcasts or running my own podcast, writing, reaching out, one-to-many communication. So you just have to block it out on your schedule and say, I'm going to write for 3 hours. I don't care what comes in.
And that does remind me, where can they find your podcast if they'd like to learn more?
Sure thing. The Foundry, we're on YouTube. We're also wherever fine podcasts are found. As The Foundry, it's misspelled on purpose, founder with a Y, because we love entrepreneurs.
Well, thanks again, George. This has been a great conversation. Again, all those links are going to be in the show notes, including the link to George's podcast. But appreciate your time, George. It was great chatting with you.
Likewise, I appreciate your time, Jack. And thank you so much for a thoughtful interview.
Have you learned at least one actionable step to incorporate into your real estate investing? If so, please consider returning some of that value by leaving a positive review, subscribing to our YouTube channel, or joining our growing network on Facebook and Twitter. You can find links to all of our social media accounts in the show notes. See you next time.